I had this insatiable need to know what was being said, as if somehow I could control it, although I couldn't. All it did was crush my literal bones. If nobody else respected me, then I was going to be somebody I could respect. Who do you say I am? Who does he say I am? Who do I know myself to be?
I love that idea of like, because I think there's a trap of like proving or pleasing. So you're both places, you're trapped in this, like, I'm going to prove them wrong, or I'm going to please these people so they like me or whatever. And somewhere, somehow, all of us, but particularly in that situation, there has to be a like, get out of that and just be who you are.
Hagar's Voice is a movement and also a podcast that we want to call your attention to. Mostly because it's a beautiful emerging movement that seeks to provide strategic support to survivors of clergy sexual abuse, as well as advocacy to change systems that perpetuate that abuse. So we're excited to be part of this Hagar's Voice movement. And as you've been listening to this podcast, hopefully you also will want to do something. So right away, you can begin to listen to Hagar's Voice podcast, which are the stories of survivors of clergy sexual abuse. That posture of listening and learning is easily practiced as you go and listen to survivors to tell their own stories, and you learn from that. Also, if you want to go to hagarsvoice.com, there are ways to support the movement coming, and we would love to have your support and spread the good news that Jesus really is on a mission to liberate.
Okay, so welcome to the Right Side Up podcast.
It's not the Danielle Strickland podcast anymore.
We keep renaming
anymore.
This podcast.
Keeps getting renamed.
Yeah. Upon threat of litigation, we renamed it again.
That's
remember?
Right.
Okay, so anyway, it is now the Right Side Up podcast, and we are doing a whole season on things we can't live with about clergy sexual abuse. And we've had some pretty robust, difficult, thorough conversation so far, and there's more to have. Uh-huh. We do start every one of these out with a trigger warning. Uh-huh. So if you are listening to this and you do have traumatic experiences in your background or you've survived abuse, we just want to assure you that we totally understand if this is not something you need to listen to or if you need to take breaks. We just want to encourage you to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. And for other people listening, just this is, we're going to just tell the truth in ways we need to tell it. So we just want to let you know ahead of time. That's how this is going to go. James and I are thrilled that Lorianne Thompson has agreed to come and speak with us. She's already spoken with me lots on the side, giving me tons of advice and her experience and hope. So Lori, I've already learned so much from you and continue to learn from you. I was one of the brokenhearted members of Twitter as I read your goodbye on the Twitter sphere, but because I continue to learn from you and will follow you wherever you go. But your experience is, you know, heartbreaking, but also filled with resilience as you have found a way to express what is true, to help others, to advocate, to speak the truth. And so we're already really grateful for you and excited that you're here to offer some of that to our audience as well.
Well, it's a privilege to be here, to be chatting with you both. And isn't it crazy? None of us would ever be together were it not for the malfeasance that is so prevalent in the church. We wouldn't be having this conversation. And thank you. I am still brokenhearted about Twitter. It's an ambivalence thing. And but it's time. It's time. And maybe that's something we can touch on as well in our conversation, just because the cost is so high of survivors who become advocates. You know, we're still survivors. And so we don't become bulletproof because we have found a voice or a place to speak or a way to communicate. We still carry a pretty high load. And so maybe we can touch on that at some point as well.
Yeah, I also wanted you to just touch quickly on the, you told me this early on that there were kind of these three phases that abuse survivors go through in their own development.
Correct.
You want to help us out with that? And maybe if you don't mind, share a little of your story in those stages, like to catch anyone who doesn't know sort of who you are and the experience that you come from.
Yeah, stories are so powerful, aren't they? And they even, it's funny, even my own story makes me weep. You know, it's still so much mine. The short version for me, if you can try to package on an index card, I grew up in a home of polyvictimization. And so that means most often abuse happens in more than one sphere. So neglect and sexual abuse, physical abuse, psychological abuse, etc. And abject poverty, substance abuse, mental health, incarceration. In terms of ACE scores, which means adverse childhood experiences, you can have a 0 or a 10. 10 is the top score. And I was always a high achiever. So I had a perfect 10. You know, left home at 15, had no choice. My father was charged with molestation of me at that time. And then since then was trying to shed the shame and the humiliation of it all. I found faith in Christ after understandably not being able to do relationships very well because I had no skills. And I sought Christ for what he could do for me. I wasn't terribly interested in what I could do for him. Isn't it amazing that, you know, love accepts us on those terms. Unfortunately, I came to faith in Christ in a toxic, abusive church. And that should be no surprise to anybody because that fit the mold, that fit my understanding, that fit my framework, and was repeatedly re-victimized as I shuffled through trying to be fed and nourished and really just to grow up and to for somebody to show me the way. I stumbled into radio ministry through a Christian broadcasting organization in Canada. And one of the individuals that I met through that was Ravi Zacharias. And my husband was a big fan of his who consumed his material. And we ended up encountering him. And then it's pretty much public knowledge now that Mr. Zacharias was credibly accused of sexual abuse and misconduct of a multitude of adult women, myself included. And that started a crescendo of a descent into what are some of the darkest days of my personal life. And that became incredibly public. And that's something I think we're going to talk about. And when a story of that nature becomes public and public, not to my, to my own wishes, in fact, the offender made that story public with his false accusations. I entered a stage of being completely unstable and profoundly unsafe, both internally and externally. And so the first phase of recovery is actually to find safety and stability. And some people stay in that stage for a really, really, really long time. You know, when we talk about safety and stability, that looks like, you know, the basal metabolic functions. Can you eat? Can you sleep? Are you physically safe? Do you have employment? Can you pay your bills? You know, that can take a really, really long time just to get there. It did take us, you know, probably a year and a half before we weren't always losing ground. You know, in the stage one, sometimes it feels like, you know, one step forward and 18 steps back, depending on what happens in the public and private foray. The next stage, once safety and stability is established, is grieving and remembering. And that's most often done with a therapeutic alliance. My strong suggestion would be that people do that with licensed professional psychotherapists who have board accountability to help them along. Because we need those backstops. We need those. So registration is a safeguard. So that means, you know, while we might be seeking spiritual care for our spirits, we also need to seek soul care for our soul, which is our mind, will, and emotions. And that soul care should be registered because clergy should be held to a much higher ethic. There's no registration standards. There's oftentimes nobody to go to but the church board. And when there's a problem in the church or with pastoral care, usually the board is stacked against any victim's disclosure or any complaints, et cetera, in favor of what's often a narcissistic or personality disordered individual, meaning the leadership. Grieving, so that's grieving and remembering. And grieving and remembering can take a long time. It's a therapeutic process. I remember Diane Langberg was quoted as saying somewhere between sort of 3 to 7 years. And I remember thinking, what? What do you mean I'm going to be doing this? I'm going to be crying for the next 3 to 7 years. And I moved through, we moved through that relatively rapidly, but always keeping in mind that look back to safety and stability, right? So if grieving and remembering causes you to be so unstable, then you have to back up from that and go back to safety and stability. And then the third phase of recovery, and this is all by Dr. Judith Herman, and it's a framework that she had proposed and I think has been validated repeatedly, both by experience and by evidence. The third phase is reintegration. So how do you get back into life? You know, trauma by nature truncates it. You know, there is a before and then whoa, there is a trauma and then there's an after. So how do you blend the before and the after? How do you come into who you are now? Because you're not the same person that you used to be. And so very often that can look like, how do I socialize again? What does it mean to go to church? Can I even worship in a public setting? What does it mean to be on social media? What does it mean to be professionally? What does it mean for me personally? All my friends are different. You know, and in many cases with clergy sexual abuse, victims and their families lose their entire communities, and the perpetrators tend to be protected and propped up. And so that often means social connections for your kids. It means education. It means school groups. There's a ton of things that need to be reshuffled. The losses are so much greater than just somebody's body. It's somebody's culture, somebody's religion, somebody's community, somebody's everything in many cases. So reintegration is another long process, and I would say that I'm still in the reintegration process. Happily, not losing ground anymore, and mostly done grieving and remembering, but I'm still a long way from where I'd like to be, but I'm not where I was either.
I loved a phrase that you used, I think today, you know, or recently, where you're like, I don't want to just be surviving. I think there's some thriving to do, you know, idea of like, there's thriving to come, which I'm also believing with you for.
Thank you.
Yes. Cue the thriving, please.
Yeah. I think that we want to skip over those three phases and go right into thriving. And, you know, religiosity would say, you know, it's all under the blood. We're all new creations in Christ, forgetting what's behind us. And that's just not how that, you know, insert whatever curse word you want to use, stuff shakes down. Right. You know, you have to walk the, you know, the pathway. It's almost like stations of the cross. And there's lots and lots and lots of parallels.
I think it's really helpful to hear those, frankly, realistic timelines. Mm-hmm. And the impact that this kind of trauma can have and the amount of time that is required to, again, I don't even want to say heal, but you say just survive. And again, this idea that you say your world has been shaken, and it is exactly that. And it's hard to stand up when the rocks are shaking underneath you. It's hard to stand up when the ship has been knocked around by the storm. And so,
when you're in chaos, everything is in chaos, it's not just chaos in you, it's chaos everywhere.
There is only chaos inside, outside, everywhere.
Yeah. And just when you think, you know, just when you think, okay, I got this little corner, I got this little patch, bam, something else happens. Especially in these really toxic and very, very volatile situations with so many stakeholders. And the more public the conflict, the more room for destabilization.
Well, that's one of the things. So on my list of things I can't live with and need to sort of express and talk about and hopefully help some others through so that this doesn't have to keep repeating itself, because that's also getting really super tired. Like surely churches, organizations, nonprofits, whatever could learn. Like this is a real thing. We could learn and do things differently. I just want to put that out there. I know it's crazy. call me an eternal optimist.
Yeah, I know. This is idealist.
But we could learn. So that's one of the ideas is like, first, I got to get this out because this can't just stay in. Like, and people have been getting this out. But I just want to use my voice to lend to that party. But I guess one of the things is about this like re-victimization and online, you know, the social media aspect and just even my own little sort of walk in that sphere and just going like, whoa, like there is a lot of re-victimization and abuse that's happening in this sort of social media world. And then Darvo and sort of that's a very familiar term for people who are in this work, but is not so familiar. Maybe people have heard it and just don't really know what it means. But do you want to walk us through like what is Darvo and a little bit around that, like, you know, one of the reasons why you're an expert in this space is not only all the work you've done in this space, but also what you survived in this space. That your, you know, really re-victimization through public means, you know, online in front of everybody, sort of being outed and being talked about and being vilified. So I think you have a special expertise in this area, just having survived it, that might be helpful to others.
Yeah. Okay.
Obviously, if you're uncomfortable sharing those pieces, these things are available. Again, you've been really, your writing is so succinct and wonderful and beautiful. And so I encourage people to kind of search that out as well. I just silence you and cut across you there, which is awful. I reading your body language, like this is clearly an incredibly painful thing. And we want to honor that and recognize that and recognize that people listening, this may be really painful for you as well. And that's okay. And take the time that you need.
I don't think we're made to be crucified in the way that we're publicly sort of crucifying victims. Social media and media in general, but you know, there's anybody can be spearing your side, you know, in the public foray. Anybody can be stealing your garments. Anybody can be playing lots at your feet. Anybody can be pressing the crown of thorns down onto your already broken and hung head. Anybody can be throwing the full weight of their accusation on the already incredible heavy load that you carry. And I part of why I don't do these things much is because it's costly. But I never want to not, that's why I carefully accept these sorts of invitations. But if we're talking about these things and we don't feel them, then we're not doing justice for the absolute atrocity that people have to undergo in these situations. So thank you for your tenderness. I didn't take it as a cutoff. I took it as an acknowledgement. And I think that one of the most important things we can do is remain in reality for how painful and sometimes how lethal these accusations are. And there's no shortage of misinformation, et cetera, including it when it comes to these sorts of situations. Victim blaming makes us all feel really, really, really good, because what trauma does is it says, it comes into your life, it blows it up, and in many ways you have zero control over what happens. You lose your choice, you lose your voice, you lose your agency. I mean, any sense of I'm in command of myself is completely flushed down the toilet. And so when we're trying to recover from that, you know, those things have to be looked at. And when we look at online vitriol for victims, when victims decide or their stories are put forward without their consent, there is no shortage of people who are willing to throw stones. I mean, that's as old as the book that we base our lives around, you know. The stones are different now. They're not literal stones, but they're just as heavy and just as hurtful. Darvo is a phenomenon that was elucidated by Dr. Jennifer Fried. She's professor emerit of the University of Oregon. She's an incredible human being and very, very, very humane. I've learned a great deal from her. Her work started in betrayal trauma theory in about the 1990s, early 90s, when there was a big big exposés in the 80s about child sexual abuse, ritual abuse, etc. And many people started to try to figure out how could these things be happening with children. She started, that work was based around recovered memories. And so how is it that people can endure abuse and they can forget, or they can put those things out of their mind? And what are the reasons for that, that they can dissociate or cannot remember, et cetera, and how these things can come back to mind? And she did a ton of research and posited something called betrayal trauma theory. And betrayal trauma theory says that the higher the degree of trust that you and I have with each other, the more I'm going to be able to, the more I'm going to need to not see the betrayal in my midst. Because we're social beings, and the more I am attached to you as an individual or as an institution, the more I need you, the more my life depends on you, the more my community depends on you, the more my faith depends on you, the more my God depends on you, the more I'm not going to be able to see the betrayal that you're already perpetrating against me. And so, and then when that happens, that we have what's called betrayal blindness, and victims can have betrayal blindness. I did. And also bystanders can. Other individuals in the organization can have betrayal blindness, and institutions can. Whole institutions can live in that level of denial. Whole nations can live in that level of denial. You only need to look to our neighbors in the South. I digress. And when we look at betrayal blindness, that helps us to explain in some ways the cognitive dissonance that we see in the church. How can we believe, truly say we believe the words of Christ, and yet treat people like such crap? We go on. And so Christians have engaged universally, at least in my circumstance, but in many others, in what's called DARVO. And Dr. Jennifer Fried was the one who used that acronym. And DARVO means the D is to deny. So the allegations are not true. That's the denial. And then to attack the victim. So not only are they not true, but you're a dirty piece of green, slimy pond scum. How could you come against this man of God? Well, the Muslims think, I heard it all. The Jezebel spirits. We're just trying to get money. The list is endless. I've tried not to keep track. It's not good for mine or anybody else's mental health. But you then attack the victim. And then very importantly, what happens is that individuals and institutions will reverse the victim and offender. So now the real victim is actually the offender. They're an agent of Satan. They're in cahoots with George Soros, or, a friendly banjo atheist who's trying to take down the Christian faith. So then the people who are trying, the whistleblower, or the victims who are trying to tell the truth, then become the offenders. And that is a phenomenon that we see played out in the public stage and in the private channels of our own lives over and over and over again. And what you had said, Danielle, earlier, and said, like, we can do better, man. Like this can change. This can absolutely change, One of the things that that research shows us is that when we educate people about DARVO, that with scenarios and vignettes, and give them information, and then they watch a DARVO scenario, most people will go, oh, well, that's DARVO. I can see that. Now I can see how that's going, right? Whereas the vast majority of people who are not educated on DARVO see a vignette, see a his and her story, or he said, she said story, and then they're trying to gauge who to believe, when all evidence tells us that we actually can't detect lying, Yeah. So one of the actual hopeful hooks to hang ourselves on is actually the dissemination of information, knowledge. We're not going to be able to eradicate predators. And there is no shortage of prey. Mm. And Christendom provides a really unique praying field, and for a ton of reasons that we can discuss if you want to later. But what we can do is level the playing field with information.
Mm. Interesting. I do have a desire, though. I felt like in a time of prayer, actually, I kept trying to make it safe for survivors in church. And I felt like God said to me, it needs to be unsafe for predators in church. So it's not just, so it might, there might be lots of them and there might be a lot of prey in terms of vulnerabilities and people, of course, coming as weak people to church. That's the whole point. That's the whole construct.
Right.
I'm one of the weakest of them, but the idea of making perpetrators unsafe there is what I think I'm after is this. If you think, and I think for years and years, perpetrators have been safe and serve and abuse victims have not been safe. But it's literally not just enough to make abuse victims safe or believed, or it's got to be where we go to. If you're a perpetrator, you will be unsafe here.
Correct.
You will be called out. You will be named. You will be, you know, disciplined. You will be properly dealt with.
And you're not going to stay at that church again. If you know it's clearly a place that is not safe for abusers, you're not going to go to that church. Right. Now, the heartbreaking thing is you may well go to another one.
Right.
But that's why we need to make all churches. But again, we are kind of weirdly hopeless optimists on this podcast, that despite the fact we keep on talking about this, these things we can't stand, it's because we believe it can be better. And again, we've seen examples of this. We see examples of churches that take this stuff seriously. And it makes, again, I don't want to give too much credit to anyone, but we can do a whole lot more than we've been doing to make it an unsafe place for abusers. And that means that abuse is less likely to happen. It just is, right? That's,
I love the idea of Darvo too, because when you're, I love the idea of Darvo as a pattern to watch for.
Oh yeah.
Because that's where I think you start really seeing it is like when you're in an experience yourself, you're prone, you know, that research that you cited. And I've always learned from Margaret Heffernan in this space where you're, a book called Willful Blindness, where you're prone, you're neurologically wired to believe the truth you want to be true.
Absolutely.
So you're just like, I want this to be true. And when we have a vested interest in somebody who is like helped us understand God or explain the scriptures to us or married our kids or like, you want a certain truth to be true. And so you have this like leaning in this direction. But if you can spot a pattern that is true in all of the stories, you know, like so many of the stories have this pattern. Your story specifically had this like kind of on steroids, partly because it was a global ministry. It was multi-denominational. Like, I just feel like in a church situation, you have a church, maybe you have the denomination and it's still a big deal. It's a lot, but you sort of had this, like all the churches, like all the denominations, like all the, in this global sort of reach personality who so many people had this vested interest in keeping as a good guy, like keeping as a guy that they could believe in because he had been so formative in their spiritual journey.
Yeah. I mean, the denial was so fierce. The attack was so, let's call it satanic. That I think that is an appropriate word for, again, when we treat people that way.
I would say satanic's a really good word because it's so viscerally horrific. In hindsight, to even read about it, you're like, I cannot believe that actually happened. Like, it's almost unbelievable that those things happened.
Wow. And those things happened at a time when church too wasn't even, and me too was just kind of growing legs. Like, it was still a salamander, not a frog, you know? I think it each step along the way, you just sort of, it's the ministry of the next thing, right? And the ministry of the mundane. And how do we survive? How do we actually survive this? As opposed to how do we take them down? How do we, I think people assign victims much more power than what they actually have because they're so unstable. They're so unsafe. You can't swing a sword very well when you're just, you know, in the quicksand, right?
I think that's a really interesting idea as well. The idea of the amount of power that we ascribe to victims as if there's a kind of, again, well, there's an accuser and accused and it's 50, you know, it's a coin flip. So who's right? We're just going to guess. And then it's like, well, if we ignore all of evidence and history and testimony, then yeah, you might be right. But if we actually listen and take time to understand and recognize again, these kind of power differentials that existed in the first place, that we're only where we are because of this, again, either abuse or complete lack of acknowledgement of power, which I think amounts to the same thing, actually. So again, this idea that yeah, again, that was what I found so horrendous about your story. And again, why I want to give you so much credit and you don't want to receive it, but that's lovely. So,
well, thank you so much. I mean, the credit, I you know, Boz Chivijan said to me years, I was so upset one time when people were just overwhelming me with vitriol, and he's like, you're a survivor. And I really just, I mean, I'm not violent, but I wanted to punch him. I'm like, what? I can't survive any more of this. And he's like, yeah, you'll be all right. You're a survivor. And he was trying to be encouraging, but I wanted to tackle him and take him down like a linebacker. But it's true to some degree that there are treasures in the darkness. And nobody wants to discuss that, at least of all me. But there is something to going deep into suffering, and not scorning the cross. And scorning the shame of it all. I think that in Christendom, like all human beings, we all want to be thought well of, but the situation that I was in caused me to lose all hope of ever being thought well of, or being known for who I really was or wanted to be. But I believe in the principle of sowing and reaping. And so, I decided that I would stay because I had kids, and that was important to me. They're important to me. They remain important to me. And I would do what I can to walk in the light and just let the light do what it should, what it says, what it promises. And we grew immensely. It's not a time that I would ever want to revisit, but it's a time that I can look back on and I can see a veritable treasure trove of growth. And depth and empathy and understanding and wisdom and knowledge and experience.
And we are also collectively seeing the light, you know, more than ever before. Like, I just feel like it's God's great expose happening across denominations and across churches. It's like we can't even keep up with the things God is bringing to light. So I think that beautiful, like, I'm going to trust the light to do its job, and here the light is, you know.
Yeah.
What would you, and I guess this is like a weird question because, you know, you're trying to survive, you know, you're literally just trying to survive the onslaught, but what are the things that you think would be helpful now? So for people listening to this, if they're surviving or they're abuse victims who have survived, what would you say are the most helpful things, even in the online place? Like, did you just like close it all down? Did you just like, I refuse to look? Did you, what would your advice be? And then I also want to get to like spectators, friends, family, church members. Do you have some, you know, just sort of like, guys, could you try this? You know?
Right. Okay. All right. Yeah, I totally can. We should circle back on the power thing when we get a minute, because I forgot to speak into that. So what did I do? I spent way too much time on social media. I think I probably lost a year of my life cumulatively. I watched very, 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 very closely for any sign that anybody other than an atheist from California might give this some sort of attention. I sat on vigil for a really, 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 really long time. I got all kinds of therapy, which was very expensive. I tried to stabilize my own internal life. And I went to graduate school to learn about abuse. I quit my profession and I just learned. I learned and 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 I learned. And that helped me tell myself the truth. Right? Because it doesn't, you know, it's somewhere in Anne Shirley where she says, like, if the whole world's against you, but you know yourself to be true, then you'll never be alone. Right?
Wow.
And don't ask me where that fortitude came from, other than there has to be a core of truth embedded in the center of my identity. For no inexplicable reason whatsoever, because nobody nourished that. And so in telling myself the truth, then I was better able to withstand the gales and gales and gales. Like, you know, like in the Darvo situation, where if the audience is educated on Darvo, they can spot it. So too, if the victims are educated on Darvo, they can withstand it better. And I had a very small table of people who I would go to, count them all on one hand. When I lost sight of reality, one of them was a therapist, another one was a lawyer, my husband, and one friend. And they would sing the song of truth back to me until I could, okay, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true. Because if I believed what everybody said about me, I'd have taken my own life. And we wouldn't be able to have this conversation. And many victims do. Darvo is deadly. Individual Darvo is deadly. Societal Darvo is deadly. Institutional Darvo is gobsmackingly suffocating. So what to do? I unfortunately read everything. So I would not recommend people read everything. I had this insatiable need to know what was being said. Is this somehow I could control it, although I couldn't. All I did was crush my literal bones. Avoiding the comment section is a really good idea on everything. But also being able to find a way to communicate the truth about who you are that is less about words and more about, you know, I realized if everybody's going to think that I'm a piece of trash, then I'm going to be, if nobody else respected me, then I was going to be somebody I could respect. And so I tried to live for an audience of one, and I lived like that for a really long time. And I think in a way it's made me immune to both the applause and the abuse. And I think that's actually a really important position for all of us to come to is, who do you say I am? Who does he say I am? Who do I know myself to be? And the rest of you can just, you know, stick it. And that's hard. That's harder to do than what it sounds.
Right? Yeah, that is harder to do than it sounds. But I love that idea of like, because I think there's a trap of like proving or pleasing. So you're both places, you're trapped in this, like, I'm going to prove them wrong, or I'm going to please these people so they like me or whatever. And somewhere, somehow, all of us, but particularly in that situation, there has to be a like, get out of that and just be who you are. And, yeah. But of course, who you are is what's under attack. So that's a lot of, I'm curious as to how you found and retained and kept your faith. In the midst of all that.
That's a tender spot, but we can go there. I've lost all faith in Christendom as an institution. Yeah. So there is no redeeming that for me as far as it goes. But I would say that faith in Christ, I have what remains is a mustard seed, and I've been informed that that's sufficient.
Who said that? Right. Can't just be putting words in Jesus' mouth like that.
Yeah, seriously. I think that when we look at the sufferings of Christ, to be victimized, in particular by the religious elite, to be cast aside, to be walked over, to be walked upon, to be suffocated, to be silenced, to be beat the crap out of, to be left,
scapegoated, all of the things on you. Yeah.
Yeah. To be beaten, to be dragged through the public square, to be hung in humiliation, to be name called is nothing short of what it means to be associated with his sufferings.
And there's a book called When Did We See You Naked? And it explores the idea of Jesus as a victim of sexual abuse as well, which I'm sure you've come into contact with. And I mean, it's a difficult read, but a really important one. And it focuses on the stripping of Jesus in particular. This is something that the gospel narrators bring up over and over again. And we miss the context and the shame and the deliberate kind of sexual shaming of Jesus in that space, in that moment, including the crucifixion itself, where he would have been naked too. And one of the most, again, heartbreaking and interesting pieces is that in that book, someone's having a conversation with survivors of sexual abuse as well. And they basically said, like, is this helpful? Like, is it helpful to think of Jesus as one whose suffering is closer to your own than maybe mainstream Christianity or preaching has kind of spoken about so far? And some ultimately say, the people that have lost their faith say, no, it's not helpful at all. I don't care. Yeah. But the people that have retained it, one of the lines that really struck me is, the thing that's most helpful for me is that we know that Jesus suffered this sexual abuse and we know that he is blameless. Like, we can look at the crucified Jesus and say, like, this is a victim that did nothing wrong. He did nothing to deserve the abuse, that sexual abuse that he received. And I think that's so important. And that teaching needs to be far more central, I think, within Christianity.
Isn't it the central message. It's one of the central messages. I mean, the crucifixion, the resurrection, ascension, all the rest of that. But it's one of the main doctrines in Christianity. We just like to skip over all the parts we don't like. But we really do like to dwell on the woman caught in the act of adultery. And there's another one that, the woman who tried to take the cloak from Joseph. So, but we totally skip over the abuse of
Potiphar's wife.
Potiphar's wife, yeah.
Potiphar's wife, yeah, sure. Yeah. We just did a whole hour on how King David was the patron saint of all clergy sexual abusers. And you might like it. I don't know. But it was helpful to put him into context and that story into full, proper biblical record. What would you say to people? What do you wish people had done in terms of, like, what could people have done differently or better? Or when it comes to online,
I feel like everything the opposite. That's what it's like. Really, like, literally everything that was done, do the opposite of that thing. That's, sorry, not to speak for you again.
No, I adore, it's a discourse. It's not a monologue. What could people have done differently? I would have been really grateful if people had just spoken to me directly. I'd have spoken to anybody. I would have been grateful if anybody, including the Christian media, had done even the most minuscule amount of research. Like, you don't have to scrape the surface very far, like at all. A rudimentary Google search would have given them a lot more information than they posted and ran with. So those two things at first blush, just for goodness sake, talk to me. I'd talk to you. I would still talk to anybody from that situation, and try to clarify what I could. The reality, you would be shocked at who does not want to talk to the actual victims. Hardly
anyone. Even an ally, for that matter. I'll tell you, there's a list of people who've never called me either. Yeah. Very interesting. I guess it goes back to that, like, people are stuck in this truth. They want to be true, and they're willing to vilify anyone that's not echoing back.
Right.
That truth.
Right.
I wonder on, so social media, so this is interesting because I've known a few survivors myself, and there is an insatiable appetite to need to know. I think it's something even about surviving itself. Like, the more information I have, the better I am prepared to deal with it. So there is, even though I would be like, please don't do that. Like, please don't read those comments. Like, please don't. There was this need to, which I think is really interesting, but,
A couple things around that. If you're going to write an article, close the comments.
Right.
Okay.
If you're going to do a tweet, close the comments. Like, make sure nobody can communicate it except for maybe your followers, or limit the amount of Darvo. Those are avenues for Darvo. So limit it. So survivors want their story to be told. The validation is nice, but being the truth being told is validating. Yes. Like, that alone is a just outcome. Right. When I first started searching for to see if there was anybody, is there anybody out there but me? There was nothing online. No other victims anywhere across the world had written anything. So even if somebody lends their power, like yourself, to another victim and says, I believe Johnny or Susie, and I stand with them. Boy, I mean, you're lending power to somebody who's powerless. And you know, I've spoken to them personally, and you lend them credibility when they have none. Nobody knows them, and what they think they know about them is not true. And they're so attached to either their institution or the individual that's being accused that they can't see. They're in a state of betrayal blindness, willful blindness, call it. You know, they're both the same thing. So lending credibility, closing avenues for Darvo in as much as possible. And there's more and more control over that. I've only done a couple of podcasts and a couple of video interviews. And one of them I had to ask the gentleman to close the comments because I couldn't help myself but go read the damn stuff. And it just got more and more vitriolic. And so that was really, and he did right away. So.
That's a good word. Close the comments. Uh-huh. I didn't even know that was a thing that you could do on Instagram till later. And I was like, dang. So guys, listen, you can like, and actually knowing that that's a thing coming, like that's the other thing about knowledge being powerful is knowing that's coming, then prepare for it and try to minimize the damage as much as possible. So
correct.
That's a good word. That's a really good word. And then if you're somebody who's a bystander or a friend or a family member, or even somebody in the church who's like not buying all of those Darvo things, solidarity is not a bad posture.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's sitting with, you know, they're sitting, making a space for them if they decide to come to church, making time for them if they don't. And just making space for the grieving process and the bewilderment and lending whatever you can lend to come alongside, to dwell with. I think back to the conversation about power, you know, when victims are inherently powerless and there the whole dynamic of abuser and abused is a power inequity. That's what allows that to be abused in the first place. So, you know, helping people to understand power, that it's in fiduciary duty, and it, this is, we are not talking about power equal people here. You know, we're not, that is not the situation that we're in with clergy sexual abuse. You know, I would go so far as to say clergy does not have the privilege of having an affair. They're in a representative. They hold the highest office.
Well, not with anyone in their congregation. They can maybe have an affair with a neighbor or something, but that's like that's the thing is it's like, this is the construct of, this is where you have power over. Uh-huh. So anything within this, you know, little uh-huh. kingdom of yours uh-huh. is not fair. It's uh-huh. not, there's no equity here. This uh-huh. is actually an abuse of,
yeah.
of power.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I wonder about the power thing as well on social media. So one of the things when you said like there wasn't anybody else, I couldn't find anybody else. There's so many survivors who will not, like, don't want to be named, who remain yes. anonymous as a result of this is why.
Yes.
It's not safe, right? And yeah. you were made public, not by desire. That was something yeah. done to you again. So like, uh-huh. and then you were able to use that then as a means of truth telling and uh-huh. which is wonderful redemption really of uh-huh. that thing that was done to you. But uh-huh. but I think that's part of that. That's why I feel like there needs to be more and more people who will lend voice to yeah. and will talk about and will say these things, because it isn't safe for people to be named uh-huh. because it isn't a fair power balance. There, the power is yeah. so much greater. So the perpetrators have all the platform.
Correct. They do.
They have all the social media. They have all the, they have the ones, they have the microphone, literally most correct. Of the time.
Yeah. Go ahead.
If you're sure. Sorry. In your case, they certainly had all the money, and that's something that came out in that story, which was really, here's something I've been chewing over because I'm angry about things, is that there was, in your own story, someone came forward and said, like, I will back this for, sorry, came to Ravi Zacharias's defense and said, I will back this for years. Like, we'll bankrupt this woman if we have to, you know what I mean? And so, here's my question. When it came out that actually you were the victim and he wasn't. Did he suddenly turn around and say, you know what, all that money I was willing to commit to defending Zacharias, I actually want to donate that to like victim advocacy. I want to donate it to you. And again, we're laughing right now, but like that's how ridiculous this situation is, right?
Can I actually put a cry out right now? So can I actually just put a plea out to people who have backed perpetrators and in their own groomed, denied, betrayed, you know, let's give you the best benefit of the doubt. Would you please back survivors now? And would you back these movements that are trying to bring light and truth and freedom to the church and for the sake of Christ? So I do want to just put a pitch out there. Whoever that guy is, I don't know who you are, but if you have money and you want to lend it to a cause, would you lend it at least as much as you spent defending perpetrators? Would you spend at least that much? Let's make it a Zacchaeus moment.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, it's like, well, the bad doesn't outweigh the good. It's like, well, you can try, you know, at least
find a victim advocacy group, find a group doing great work. You're working with folks, Lorianne, that are doing wonderful things. Find some victim advocacy, some survivor led things and donate to them. That's one of the great ways we can help use our power to shift some things and to help support some people.
Oh, money is power. There's no, you know, no question about it. So, and you know, where your treasure is, your heart will be there also. So let's assess where our hearts are. A significant portion of the settlement that I received went to fund survivor, led initiatives. So, you know, even if it's the survivors themselves, when you, you know, when you found solid ground, for goodness sake, go back and shine a light in whatever way allows you to be safe, but to contribute in a meaningful way, whether that's finances or, you know, a meal or whatever have you.
Just to like touch on that a little bit more, and this might be an entirely different conversation. I know that one of the attacks, and probably the loudest one and the most obvious one, is, you know, they're just doing this for money, which is this kind of default response, because I guess because there's no other reason, right? Like there's no other I want to humiliate myself and my family and like bring all these like horrendous things that I wish had never happened into the light. The only possible explanation could be that, like, well, there must be some incentive, like, I mean, all they're telling the truth. And again, from our limited experience, at least with people who have been victims in this way, I'm like, do you know how much money people actually make from this? Like, I hate to break your heart, but like, I'm going to pop that myth right now. And basically everyone I know has ended up poorer for the experience.
No, that's true. The, again, it's another way of victim blaming. So, it's just another way to explain to yourself why these adverse events are happening to either an individual or an institution that you are so attached to, that you have a strong attachment bond to. And you have a vested interest, whether it's for financial reasons, for faith reasons, for cultural reasons, for education reasons, for even just, if you're good, I'm good, because we're friends, right? For whatever the source of the attachment, people need to tell themselves those things so that they can explain away what's going on. And in Christendom, as in any other religion, if you can blame it on the enemy, then boy, I mean, you've got all your eggs in that basket. It's very easy to spiritualize. Most clergy sexual abusers sexualize the sacred in order to abuse. And then they use the sacred to justify their Darvo and their, you know, their campaign to protect themselves and protect the institution. Incidentally, it was not that long ago that I found out who was funding Zacharias. And it was a billionaire. I think the day that I found out that he was then also indicted on racketeering.
The light comes.
Billionaires shouldn't exist. This is a different conversation, but before we even get there.
So you can't make this stuff up. And I keep going back. It's so simple, but even if nobody else thinks you're true, so long as you know and you stay in the light and you stay who it is that you believe Christ wants you to be and who it is, somebody that you can love and respect. And if you stay in that, then whether it happens in your lifetime or not, truth has a way of rising up to defend itself. Yeah. Just give it time.
Yeah. Wow. And to know it to be true. I think that's beautiful. So I was with a survivor who finally a church eventually apologized, not well, but like eventually it was like, oh shoot, we should have probably done this 9 months ago or whatever. Uh-huh. And I remember even her just saying like, the truth now is for you, not for me. Yeah. I already know what's true.
Exactly.
I live the truth.
That girl's well on her way.
Right. And so, and that, but the, even that, like, I know what's true. I don't need you to validate what's true. I know what's true. This truth is for your, it's for your healing. Cause actually that's truth is an invitation to healing for all of us, no matter what side of the, you know, whether you're a perpetrator or whether this truth is an invitation to step towards healing and it's for you. And, and if you accept it, good for you, because that's a way to move into healing. But if you don't, then to wait for it, it'll come back. Like it's going to hit you one way or another, you know, like.
It's a matter of how. And, and I think that leads nicely into something that I try to communicate to people all the time. Divorce yourself from the outcome. Like there are just outcomes other than the ministry failing, the perpetrator still, vast majority of time perpetrators are still in the ministry. So don't hold your head out for that. And, you know, vast majority of time perpetrators are not arrested or incarcerated. The vast majority of time there is a sort of a ministry 2.0 where they come back into ministry because they've learned so much from their, you know, sin. So to the degree that you can stop giving your offender or offending institution rent-free space in your head, you have won.
Right.
Right.
That's great. That is so good. And yeah, divorce yourself from the outcome because the process of truth telling is its own win.
Right.
That's the win. You're true to yourself. You did your best to speak the truth to protect other people. Like that was the job.
Yes.
And then the other job is God's work is other people's decisions. But like your job is fully done when you've done that.
Your job isn't that the justice system does what it's supposed to, because it doesn't half the time. And your job isn't to convince everyone in the world or every bad faith act or every skeptic, because that's impossible. Your job is to speak the truth. And
Yeah.
Well, and you're at the perpetrator in this, in your case, died a saint.
Hmm. Yeah. I wanted to dig a hole and bury myself that day.
I bet.
Yeah.
As people from around the world, like and even I remember going like, no, what? Like even with enough doubt to know, like, this is unsettled. Like, we don't know what's going on. Like, there's so many questions, like, but people just sort of posting pictures of them with him and stuff. And so even that idea that there is a reckoning, his truth is coming on the other side, you know, he has to give some sort of account, and that's all a thing that we believe. But in the here and now, if you don't divorce yourself from the outcome, you're going to allow that perpetrator or that system or that institution to have power still.
Right. So then who has the power, right? Not you. You're not empowered in your own life. You're now still looking for an outcome you can't control. So there's tons of just outcomes I could control. I could control who I would become. I could not, and what I was going to believe and what I was going to understand and know, how I could change, and how I can try to influence the world for a greater awareness. But I could not and will not spend my lifetime trying to make sure that everybody understands, or that the ministry is taken down, or contribute to every possible, you know, new news break for whatever individual is now doing a branch off thing. It's just not, it's not my circus, and it's not my monkey anymore. It's theirs. Yeah, I love how you said that.
Yeah, that's really good. Well, your experience and hope never fails to bring light wherever you go. We feel that. I feel that in what you write. I feel that in what you say. Thanks for braving greatly here again and showing us what it looks like to be a light in dark places. And we're going to keep cheering you on and supporting and praying and try to brave greatly along with you. Is there anything that you want to say to anybody listening, or any place that you want to send people to, or places people can track with light bearers in this season?
Oh boy. There are in every sphere, including in advocacy, there are people with mixed motives. And so most survivors are watchers. So I would urge you to watch an individual over the course of a season, look for how they treat other individuals or other, and try to seek out individuals who are helping to empower you as opposed to pattering their own platform, and avoid anybody who tells you what to do because they have no idea what you should do. Because they're not you. Draw yourself to people who will help you learn to think critically about your own situation and help you to make actual decisions that are your own, that we've thought through a safety plan and your next steps, and that you, even if the outcome's a complete crap, but at least you made the decision and you knew some of what was coming, as opposed to the outcome being complete crap and you were being told what to do again. When survivors necessarily often want saviors, there is no savior but one. So don't look for them, because they don't exist. There's only one true hero. Okay, we can be humane, but the best of us out here in this, whatever this is, this arena, are those who go, okay, what do you need? You need a drink? Okay, you got a backpack? You got your torch? Where are you going for the next step? Okay, here's the map, and here's who you should talk to next. They're resource providers, and they help you map out your own territory, because the map doesn't look anything like the territory. And if I just give you instructions, then I'm doing to you what other people have done, and I'm controlling your life. So is there any one individual? No, I wouldn't name names, because I think that people need to be able to learn to observe and discern who is safe and what is safe and what's not. And people should... or trust is earned. Just because somebody has a position or a platform doesn't mean they're trustworthy.
Yeah. So I love that idea of watch and learn. And I love even what you said of like, look for how they treat people around them. That's a good sign. You know, like that, look for their interactions, look for their track record, look for their, you know, relationships. And
yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We sure appreciate it.
Oh, it was an honor and privilege. Thank you both. Thank you for having me. I'd come back again.